Welcome to the Woodridge Baptist Church Podcast. For more information about what's happening in the life of our church, visit our website at www.woodridge.org. Enjoy the podcast.
All right, friends. So we start a new series today, and so I invite you to turn to 1 Kings chapter 17, and we're going to begin by taking a look at the life of Elijah, and then Elijah is going to hand off the baton. Just like every great leader that you see in Scripture, there comes a point where their work is done, at least in some ways, and then they hand off the baton. Moses hands off the baton. Elijah is going to hand off the baton. But we want to find out who this guy is. We want to see the impact that this guy had. And so that's why we're going to take a look at 1 Kings chapter 17. And let me give you a little bit of background here as to what's going on in these people's lives. If you look at it, let's take a look at Israel. Israel was, as we would say, Israel is a train wreck. It's just an absolute mess. At one point, they were a united group, and then they divide. When you look at Israel, they were founded upon monotheism. It was that God is the one that's ultimately leading this place, and you know, eventually some kings show up. It wasn't even anything that God wanted, but the people were clamoring for it, and so God says, fine, you can have a king. And a lot of the kings didn't lead very well, to say the least. But a civil war had split Israel into two different kingdoms. There was a northern one, and there was a southern one. The northern kingdom was called Israel, and the southern kingdom was called Judah. Now, isn't that just like people? You know, you take a good thing, and then you have to mess it up. Now, the northern kingdom had a succession of bad and ungodly kings, 19 of them to be exact, spanning over about 200 or so years. 200 years of bad leadership. I mean, that's quite a while, isn't it? You imagine that it's not just that the leaders are bad, but kind of the way that they're leading is not going to be good for the people that are under their leadership. Two centuries of bad kings. And this culminates in about 875 BC with the worst one of them all, a guy named Ahab. Have you ever heard of him? Now, this guy was a mess. Now, Ahab marries this cute little thing from a neighboring pagan nation called Sidon, and her name was Jezebel, and she brought into Israel her favorite gods. Now, she comes from a place that doesn't worship God. They worship other things. Idolatry was a thing. And so Ahab, in all of his infinite wisdom, decides to go and hook up with her. Now, she probably was a looker, right? So he gets this thing for her, brings her back, and there's a problem. It's not just that he has an attraction to her, it's that he welcomes her in, and then he brings her back to the people that he's leading. And she brought into Israel her favorite gods, Baal and Asherah, and they promptly began to set up temples for them. That didn't take very long, did it? Now, of course, you're probably looking at Ahab, and you think, well, I mean, he wants her to be happy because happy wife, happy life, right? Now, by the way, I don't like that phrase. It's happy spouse, happy house, right? Happy spouse, happy house. But he wants to keep the girl happy. And he's like, well, you know what? How about this? How about we just start building some temples for the gods that you worship? And she's like, I think that's a great idea. And then how about we invite all of the people that I've been horribly leading all of this time to worship all of your false gods? And she goes, I think that's a great idea. That's what's going on here. Now, think about the people. Because just because a leader says, hey, here's what we need to do, did you know that doesn't mean that the people have to follow, right? They don't have to follow. But the people were so far away from God that they went along with her, primarily because Baal and Asherah, well, they promised prosperity, and we all like prosperity, don't we? And they also promised protection, and we love our security, don't we? And so there are the promises there. And during a time when Israel felt like, you know, we really need this. We need provision and we need protection. But the worship of these gods, it became increasingly more dark. Like it kind of starts well, you know, protection and provision. And you go, that sounds great. But then it starts to get really, really dark. They even practiced child sacrifice. Not good. And after a few years, after Jezebel was firmly in power, you know, he basically lets her take over, and he's just kind of a front of leadership. She slaughters hundreds of the prophets of God and the priests of God, and in their place, she sets up the prophets of her own. Well, now you've got the takeover, right? We're going to get the people out of the way that are going to be in the way. And by the way, who is it that has the most clout in the land aside from the one that's in elected office? It's going to be the religious leaders, The ones that day in and day out are with the people, ministering to the people, and teaching the people, we're going to get them out. And then we'll put my people in place. Now you know why it is that Israel is an absolute train wreck. This isn't going well. And for the first time really in Israel's history, the folks are sitting there going, you know what, we have some options here. Your religious beliefs are a lot like Luby's. I mean, what do you want to order today? Because she brought all of this in. And you go, we don't necessarily have to worship the one true God. Look at these other possibilities. And so they did. And the people split. It's a mess. That's Israel. However, God sends a person. And his name is Elijah. And when you look at Elijah, in chapter 17, verse 1, it says, Elijah the Tishbite, or as I always used to say, the Tickbite. Elijah the Tishbite. Now, Elijah, you just take a look at his name. What does it mean? It means Yahweh is my God. Yahweh is my God. Not Baal is my God. Not Asherah is my God. Yahweh is my God. And this tells us something, not just about Elijah, but it tells us something about his parents. His parents were people of faith. See, now back then, you would name your child. The name of your child meant something. It spoke to who they're going to be. It spoke to the content of their character. We were talking to our girls about this, and honestly, Wendy and I didn't necessarily follow that line when we were naming the girls, because Avery said, well, what does my name mean? Is Lord of the Elves. Whatever. It does mean that, by the way. That just isn't why we picked it. We picked it because Wendy said, it's pretty. It's pretty. How many of you named your kids like that? Don't lie. You did. You did. I see some hands. That's good. We didn't necessarily have this in mind, right? But his parents were people of faith. Now, why does a prophet show up? I mean, why appoint this guy to do something? And the answer is because of the mess that the people were in. There's a spiritual issue among God's people, and it has to be addressed. God's just not going to let it. He's not just going to let it happen. So to get a snapshot of what's going on, if you look at 1 Kings chapter 16, verses 32 and 33, you get an idea. It says, he, that is Ahab, set up an altar for Baal in the temple of Baal that he built in Samaria. Ahab also made an Asherah pole and did more to arouse the anger of the Lord, the God of Israel, than did all of the kings of Israel before him. Okay, so they were bad. This guy has ticked God off more than all of them combined. It's really bad. So the problem that Elijah is asked to address is the problem of idolatry. Ahab is worshiping Baal and Asherah. He brings Israel to worship them with him. And they're looking to Baal to provide basically rain. They need crops and they need fertility, meaning literal reproduction. So they're looking to Baal to provide that. And the people were so far from God that they go along with it primarily because Baal and Asherah, you go, who are they? They promise prosperity. They promise protection. So they keep going back there. This is a good place to go. Now, Elijah, when you think about him, it's not just that the worship is dark. It's that Elijah is a guy that's going to be kind of standing alone in all of this. It's not just that the government leaders are going this way. It's that the whole country seems to be going this way. And one of the things about Baal worship that we know, why call out to Baal, is because Baal is going to provide these things that you cherish the absolute most. You want security. You want to eat, and so Baal's going to provide that. Now, Elijah, he's going into Baal's house. And what he does in chapter 17, verse 1, if you look at it, he says this. He said, as the Lord, the God of Israel, lives before whom I stand. So he already tells you where he's coming from. I don't ultimately stand before you. I stand before him. And as the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, before whom I stand, there will be neither dew nor rain these years except by my word. Now, Elijah has just put a target on his head, because here's what he's saying. You're calling out to Baal and Asherah for rain and crops and for literal reproduction, because this is how their economy worked. You're not only not going to get rain, you're not going to get dew. There's going to be no moisture on the ground. And you know why? Because me. Because God has sent me. And until I speak otherwise, this isn't going to happen. Do you think that the people that are against him think, all right, this guy's now a target for us? Because I would guess so. The impact? Israel is in trouble. No rain, no crops, no economy. The people are absolutely panicked. It's not a good place as a nation. So what God does, he sends Elijah in to do this, to attack Israel at the place of their idolatry. He wants to attack Israel at the place of their idolatry, what it is that they are ultimately worshiping rather than God. And this is something that we need to understand this morning. If there is something in your life that has become an idol, and we're all idolaters, John Calvin is absolutely right. Our heart is an idol factory. It just pumps these things out. But if there's something in your life that has become an idol, don't be surprised that God shuts it down. If money is your idol, don't be surprised God might shut that down for you. If a relationship is your idol, do not be surprised if God shuts this down for you. He sent Elijah in to do some shutting down. You can take it to the bank that God is probably going to do some shutting down for you. And it's not easy. It's hard. It hurts. Tim Keller wrote a book called Counterfeit Gods. It's really good. I recommend it. But here's what he invites you to consider. And he invites me to consider the same thing. And I'm just going to read some things for you this morning. He says, consider this. Life only has meaning, or I only have worth if. My life has meaning, or I only have worth if. Now consider this. Only if I have power and influence over other people. Well, that's power idolatry. Or how about this? I am loved and respected by, and you fill in the blank. That's approval idolatry. By the way, if you're in a position of leadership, you got to get over that one quick. How about this? I have this kind of pleasure experience, a particular quality of life that I just want. That's comfort idolatry. I'm able to get mastery over my life in the area of, you fill in the blank. This is control idolatry. People are dependent on me and they need me. This is helping idolatry. I mean, where would the world be if I didn't do these things? Someone is there to protect me and keep me safe. This can be dependence idolatry. I'm completely free from obligations or responsibilities to take care of anybody else. That's independence idolatry. I'm highly productive. I'm getting a lot done. That's work idolatry. I'm being recognized for my accomplishments and I'm excelling in my work. That's achievement idolatry. I have a certain level of wealth, financial freedom. After all, that means I don't need you people. And very nice possessions. That's materialism idolatry. I'm adhering to my religion's moral codes and accomplished in its activities. I mean, I'm doing great. I even volunteer on Sundays. That's good, but that could be religion idolatry. This one person is in my life and happy to be there, and or they're happy to be with me. This is individual person idolatry. I mean, they just give me everything I need, so. I feel I'm totally independent of organized religion and am living by a self-made morality. Heard that one lately? This is irreligion idolatry. And by the way, it doesn't make any sense to me either. I don't like organized religion. Do you like it to be disorganized? I'm just saying. My race and culture is ascendant and recognized as superior. Racial or cultural idolatry. A particular social grouping or professional grouping of other groups lets me in. That's inner ring idolatry. My children or my parents are happy and happy with me. This could be family idolatry. It ain't always going to work like that, and especially if you're parenting your kids. They're not going to like you at times. Mr. or Mrs. Wright is in love with me. Relationship idolatry. I'm hurting. I'm in a problem, and only then do I feel worthy of love or able to deal with guilt. This is suffering idolatry. My political or social cause is making progress and ascending in influence or power. It's the most important thing to me. Well, this is ideological idolatry. Or how about this? I have a particular kind of look or body image, and this is the most important thing to me. This is image idolatry. Years ago, you might remember the tennis player Andre Agassi. He hooks up with Canon Rebel cameras, and the whole thing was image is everything. Well, it's not, but it's what they ran with. All of these things, if we're not careful, become idols in our life, and they replace what really is the source of worship and hope. So as you continue to read on in 1 Kings chapter 17, verses 2 through 5, here's what it says. And so the word of the Lord came to him. I want you to depart from here, turn eastward, hide yourself by the brook Cherith, some say Cherith, which is east of the Jordan. You shall drink from the brook, and I've commanded the ravens to feed you there. So he went, and he did according to the word of the Lord. Okay, when you look at this, you see two things. One, the brook, that's just natural provision, isn't it? That's just kind of running water. But then you have the other part, and it's the ravens, and that part's just weird. I don't care who you are, it is weird. Anytime God does something supernatural, it's kind of an eye popper. It's an eye catcher, and it's meant to be. Can you imagine seeing a miracle of God and going, eh, yeah. I mean, that's just not the way it works. But he says, go, and I'm going to provide for you. One, you're going to have running water. That's awesome in a time where there's not a lot of water. And the ravens are going to be dropping some food for you. Now, the word cherith, just so you know, comes from the ancient Hebrew word meaning to cut away or to cut out or to cut off. And this shows that what God is taking him there to do, it's a season of preparation where he's got some cutting to do in the life of Elijah so that Elijah is ready for what God's going to do through him. And he says, I've commanded the ravens to feed you there. There is an emphasis on the word there. I've commanded them to feed you there. He doesn't say just go anywhere that you want to and I'm going to provide for you. He says, go here. And one of the first lessons that we see in the preparation of a prophet is the prophet is willing to follow the word of the Lord even in the small things. I said, go here. I didn't say go anywhere and I'm going to provide for you. I've commanded the ravens to feed you. He promised the ravens are going to feed him as long as he stays there. And of course, theoretically, they could feed him anywhere, right? I mean, if God's the one directing them. But Elijah perhaps wanted to be somewhere else, if you think about it. I don't want to be there. There's somewhere else to go. Maybe he wants to go ahead and start the ministry of kind of proclaiming to people. Maybe he just wants to do something else, but I don't necessarily want to go there. He says, my provision is there. Yet God wanted him there. He says, I'm going to provide for you there. Have you had the same kind of thing? I'll just go anywhere, wherever I go. I think God's just going to take care of me. It's not what he said to Elijah. But here's what he does. He gives bread and meat in the morning. He gives bread and meat in the evening. We have a word for that, y'all. He gives them a sandwich, right? He gives them a sandwich a couple times a day. But it reminds us of something very important. First thing in the life of Elijah, and it's this. If dependence on God is the goal, if there are all these other things that they or you are depending on, that you've replaced God with, if dependence is the goal, dependence on God is the goal, your weakness is an advantage. If dependence on God is a goal, then your weakness is an advantage. I mean, after all, Elijah, he's like the rest of us. He used to work for his food. He'd go work during the day, and then he goes to the market at the end of the day, that because they usually got their wage in the day. They'd get the food, they'd eat together, get up tomorrow, do it again. He used to work for food. Now he gets his food at God's hand, at God's time, and in God's location. That's how he's provided for. If you look at every miracle in the Bible, every miracle in the Bible starts with a problem. Something is going really wrong here. It could be death, it could be something else. But in this case, for Elijah, his strength was his greatest enemy. I've always just taken care of myself, so, you know, no need. No need. I'm good. Can I just recommend to you this morning, make sure that your resources that you're blessed with are not an idol. It's not bad to have them. It's bad to worship them. So here's the question that Elijah has. It's a question for us this morning. Where has God made you weak? Where has God broken you down? The goal and the purpose for the breaking, my friends, is for the making. To pull out what it is that you're worshiping and to put in something that was meant to be there all along. So is it financial? Is it that you're single? Is it that there's been a removed opportunity for you? I don't know. But here's what's interesting. In Deuteronomy 14, God said that ravens were unclean birds. They're unclean birds. Every bit of food that came to Elijah came from the beak of an unclean animal, and that tells us something else. God can use whatever God wants to do to provide. And just so you know, I am in a lot of ways an unclean man. I was never called to pastoral ministry because I had my act totally together or because I was perfect. I have seen over the years of ministry that what God does is often uses me in spite of me because I'm broken. Because I'm broken. But he can still use me. God can use what is unclean to do his work, and that means that God can use every single one of us in this room. And so in verse 7 it says, and it happened after a while, the brook dries up. Oh man, can you imagine going to this brook, the water's running, and you go, yeah, you know what? I kind of hated coming here to begin with, but now I kind of like it because I've got water and I've got a sandwich twice a day, and that's a pretty good day. And it happens after a while, the brook dries up because there had been no rain in the land. Well, who was it that proclaimed no rain in the land? Elijah. Elijah did it. And now he gets on the receiving end of the judgment he prayed would come down on the people. Does that sound like anybody else that you know? Have you ever looked at a person? You look at Elijah, he's the prophet. He's the one that's called out. He's the one that's set apart. Know anybody else that was called out, set apart, and the judgment came down on them as well? Because there was a curse in the land? Sounds a little bit like Jesus, doesn't it? Or maybe a lot of bit like Jesus. When we look at Elijah, he's not just on the receiving end of the judgment that he had proclaimed. At first, God shelters him from the judgment in his provision, when you think about it. He provides for him supernaturally. He gives him the brook. And now the things are affecting him, and things start drying up. Can I suggest this to you this morning? Don't buy into the idea that serving the Lord means that things won't dry up for you. You know, if I just serve the Lord, then everything's going to be, it's going to be all right. As long as I'm in the center of his will, it's going to be all right. No, it dried up for this guy. And the drying up was basically the prompt to say, time to move on. I'm drying this up. God might be drying up some stuff in your life. It might be a career. It might be something else. But drying it up. And that's the prompt. That's the pat on the back. That's the attaboy, attagirl, whatever you want to say. It's that to say, and it's time for a change. I'm taking you somewhere else for other ends. And so in verse 8, it says, and then the word of the Lord came to him, that is Elijah, saying, arise, go to Zarephath, which belongs to Sidon, and dwell there. See, I have commanded a widow there to provide for you. Now, one, are you going to believe God so far? Go to this brook, I'm going to provide for you, and ravens are going to be dropping food. Go over here, there's a widow that's going to be providing for you. Now, when did the word of the Lord come to him? And the answer is, when things dried up, the word of the Lord came. And God leads Elijah from the dry brook to a Gentile city. These aren't even my people, right? These aren't even my people. This would be like an Aggie going to a Longhorn game, the only one standing in the stands with maroon on. It's like that. These are not my folk. It's unusual. It's a challenging move for Elijah to make. But did you see something about Elijah? What does he say? All right, let's go. And we should also remember that this is the region that Jezebel was from. So now I'm going to take you from a creek, sounds all right, and I'm going to take you to the center of where that lady is from. Oh, this just, the plot thickens, right? I mean, how many of you would want to be there? But he says, I've commanded a widow there to provide for you. Now, widows, by the way, they were poor. They were notoriously poor. So strange one to pick. Instead, you think, hey, I've got a rich person, got a big house, tons of food. Don't worry about it. I've got a poor lady that's there to feed you. And God tells Elijah, go to a Gentile widow and receive provision from her. And it probably seemed to make more sense just to wait beside a dry brook, at least at this point. But when you think about Jesus, this story was brought up a little bit later. Because when he was rejected by his own people, and he was, Jesus used this example of Elijah's coming to the widow of Zarephath as an illustration of God's right to choose a people to himself. So he says this, he says, I say to you, no prophet is accepted in his own country, but I tell you truly, many widows were in Israel in the days of Elijah, when heaven was shut up for 3 years and 6 months, and there was a great famine throughout all the land, but to none of them was Elijah sent, except to Zarephath in the region of Sidon, to a woman who was a widow. This lady's story stuck, and Jesus mentions her. A weird way to provide. It's like a strange way to learn a lesson. It's almost like the Karate Kid. How many of you have seen the Karate Kid? Did you ever see the old one, the real one, you know, not the new, not good one. The old one where, you know, Daniel's son is like going to Miyagi because he keeps just getting whipped by these guys, and he's tired of the whipping. And so, you know, Miyagi agrees to take him on kind of as a son. And he brings Daniel's son in. But what does he do? He's like, well, wax the car. Paint the fence. No, like, do you remember what I'm talking about? Now, after a while, Daniel's son's sitting there going, all right, I think this guy's just getting free labor. It's how he felt. Until there was kind of that moment, right, where he's about to walk away from it all. And Miyagi walks up to him and he says, okay, Daniel's son. And then they start to do the drills, right? Paint the fence, and he starts punching. He's like, psh, 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 psh. You know what I'm talking about? Well, when you watch the movie, He could not see that all of those things that he was being put through by Miyagi were the training ground for what he was about to do. You might feel the same way. Everything that you're going through, you may not know it right now, but it's a training ground for something that God's going to do. And so in verses 11 through 14, he says, so he arises, he goes to Zarephath, and when he came to the gate of the city, indeed a widow was there gathering sticks. And he calls to her and he says, bring me a little water in a cup that I can drink. By the way, he sounds like a bossy guy, right? Hey, lady. All right. And as she was going to get it, he called to her and he said, please bring me a morsel of bread in your hand. So she said, as the Lord your God lives, I do not have bread, only a handful of flour in a bin, a little oil in a jar. And see, I'm gathering a couple of sticks that I can go in and prepare it for myself and my son, that we can eat it and die. That doesn't sound positive. And Elijah said to her, do not fear. Go and do as you said, but make me a small cake from it first. Bring it to me, and afterward make some for yourself and your son. For thus says the Lord God of Israel. You think that would stick out? For thus says the Lord God of Israel, not Baal, not Asherah. The bin of flour shall not be used up, nor shall the jar of oil run dry until the day the Lord sends rain on the earth. Heard that before? It's going to come by my word, and I'm here with you. So for the widow, here's what she has to do. She has to replace her fear with trust. You will have to replace fear also with trust. Go and do as you have said, but make me a small cake from it first. Go and eat, but feed me first. Hello? How about feed yourself and your son, and then you can get around to feeding me? He's like, no, we're going to do it the other way around. This was a huge request from her. One, she's poor, but he asks this widow to first give him something from her last bit of food. And this seems like, one person said, this seems like the worst kind of predatory fundraising. Let's just find the most destitute and take from them. Here was the difference, though. There was a promise for her. There was a promise. Your supply is not going to run out. Your supply is not going to run out. So what does she do? She responds the same way that Elijah responded before. God says, this is what I want you to do. She responds in the exact same way. Elijah goes, and she goes. In verse 15, it says, so she goes away. She did according to the word of Elijah, and she and he and her household ate for many days. Here's what you find. As both of these people listened to God and did what God said, the blessing was mutual. The blessing went both ways. Elijah needed to eat, and Elijah ate. But also this woman who realizes that her resources were running out tapped into a resource that never ran out. As the Lord your God, the God of Israel, lives. She called out to him. So when God sees idolatry, here's something that I think will happen. He'll bring famine to the land. There is no country that is above it. There is no country that is beyond it, not even ours, maybe most especially ours. To break it down, to put back into place what he has intended for his people. He will bring famine to a land. A famine of money, maybe a famine of comfort. I don't know. But here's the way, if you look at the end of 1 Kings chapter 17, I love the way that it ends. I love it. Because it says something about Elijah. There's some other things that have happened that we'll get to later. But in 1 Kings chapter 17, verse 24, Elijah is identified simply as the man of God. He's the man of God. How did 1 Kings 17 begin? Elijah the Tishbite. Elijah the Tickbite. Elijah, where he's from. By the end of the chapter, Elijah, the man of God. He's gone from being defined from where he's from to being defined who he belongs to. And this lady can see it. Friends, this morning I want you to consider a few things. And the way that we end our worship services is we portion some time for you to talk with the Lord. Because you have a moment where you're undistracted. You're here. And we want these moments to be honest. We want them to be honest with God. We've considered a number of things that are a little bit different from them than us, but did you know that we all still have the problem of idolatry? For what I provided from Tim Keller, there were only 20 questions that he asked to identify the range of possible idols that we can have. Because you know what, friends? We can have more than one. And this just isn't it. It's not what we're meant for. We're meant for more. The real object of our love, affection, our focus, our adoration is meant to be none other than Jesus himself. And so in these moments, we're going to take time just to bow our heads, close our eyes. It's just to remove distractions. That's it. And so I invite you to do that. We're going to give you a little bit of time to talk with the Lord, a moment of honesty, a moment of confession, where you can name your idol and ask Jesus to do what he did for Elijah and the others that you see here, and to break them so that you can have communion with him in ways that these idols have kept you from. The chief end of man is to know God and to enjoy him forever. And so what is it that's keeping you from that joy?
We hope you have enjoyed the podcast. For more information about our church, visit www.woodridge.org.